going to get sicker if you don't take care of yourself.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Senate Committee on Healthcare. It's Tuesday, April 25th, 2017, and let's start off with opening a public hearing on House Bill 2114A. And do you want to explain the bill and come forward, Representative?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you, is House Bill 2114-8, brought to you by Representatives Greenlick and Williamson. The bill directs the Oregon Medical Board, the Oregon State Board of Nursing, and the Oregon Board of Dentistry to provide notice to licensees regulated by each board who are authorized to prescribe opioids or opiates of the Oregon opioid prescribing guidelines. There's a minimal fiscal impact, no revenue impact. There is a dash 7 on OLIS. It was posted at 12:09, so we can't talk about it for another, looks like, about 5 minutes.
We can talk about it.
And this bill passed out unanimously out of the House.
Representative Greenlick.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlick from House District 33. Glad to be in front of you and my senator with us today. This is a... And it's current from a very simple bill. I'm not sure what the amendment will do to make it more complex, but this bill started as a copy of a Massachusetts statute which limited if a prescriber on a first visit with a patient to a 7-day supply of opiates. It's been successful, I think, in two other states. While we were processing the bill, During that time, the state created a process for establishing a set of guidelines on the proper prescribing of opiates. And the decision was made, rather than putting a prescribing pattern into statute, to make reference to that set of guidelines that had been developed, and to require the boards of prescribers of opiates, essentially medical board and the nursing board and the dental board, to take cognizance of those guidelines, essentially endorse them, and then inform their licensees that they ought to practice according to those guidelines, and to put a little more teeth into it than that. So essentially that's what the bill does. It recognizes that guideline process. It had no opposition from the boards or from any of the professional organizations. And it will make, I think, a little bit of a dent in our opioid problem.
Yes, Senator Steiner Hayward.
Thank you. And I see Mr. Donovan in the back. He may want to comment on the dash 7. Representative, the dash 7 simply add the Oregon Board of Naturopathic Physicians to the bill. It's a very simple amendment. It was an inadvertent omission over on the House side, so I would hope that that would be something you'd be comfortable with.
That'd be no problem at all.
Great. Thank you very much. And I see a thumbs up from Mr. Donovan in the back, which is great. Thank you, Mr. Donovan. And Madam Chair and Representative Greenlick will support this. They also passed House Bill 2518, which I'm sure we'll be seeing at some... Oh, I think that went to Ways and Means, actually. Which is a even more involves the prescription drug monitoring program, working with people who are prescribing at sort of outer limits of the prescribing practices, and so we can target the people who are the real bad actors. So the combination of this bill, which I'm grateful to Representative Greenlick for bringing, and that one will really make a difference, we hope.
Great. Thank you. All right. Any other questions? Thank you, Representative.
Does that mean I have to go off to my committee now?
Yeah.
No, come on. Like I had to go to mine yesterday when I testified in front of you.
Oh, darn.
Great, so.
A lot of that going around.
Courtney Dresser in Anaheim.
Good morning, or good afternoon. Courtney Dresser for the Oregon Medical Association, and both the chair of the Health Healthcare Committee and Senator Steiner Hayward took my testimony. Sorry. So I will have to just say, just a little bit of background, that the guidelines that were done by the Oregon Health Authority were done after the Centers for Disease Control issued guidelines in March of last year. Something that the community, the prescribing community, has been wanting and needing for a while. Those guidelines were then looked at by a large group of prescribers in Oregon, including pharmacy and safety net clinics, and they created the Oregon Opioid Prescribing Guidelines in November, and I believe they are on OLIS for you to review. The task force adopted the guidelines of the CDC and also developed recommendations on Oregon-specific concerns. These guidelines, through dissemination and communication, will become becoming part of the standard of care for all providers in Oregon. And this bill plays an important task. All the boards that are licensed, have licensed prescribers, once the A7 amendment is adopted, will need to notify their prescribers of these guidelines. And that is an important first step. And then, as the senator alluded to, there is a second additional step in 2518 that has passed the House Healthcare Committee and is heading to a Ways and Means Committee, not with a very large fiscal, but with some okay to use some other funds. So we hope to see 2518 go through too. And I think with those two combination bills, we will have some high hopes for some changing of our status quo when it comes to opioids.
Great.
Thank you, Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee. My name is Nan Heim, and I represent the Oregon Association of Orthopedic Surgeons and the Oregon Academy of Ophthalmology. And the orthopedic surgeons, of course, are particularly interested in this because they are major prescribers of opioids. But as physicians, they are very much interested in being part of the solution to the opioid problem. And on the House side, Chair Greenlich asked us to come up with something we thought would get the message across. And we really felt strongly that the licensing boards were the way to go, because my experience working with these two associations is that when they get a message from their licensing board, they hear that message. So we strongly support House Bill 2114A. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. No opposition. So we can probably work this when you want to post it. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2114A and open a public hearing on House Bill 2301A.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you is House Bill 2397A, brought to you by the Oregon State Pharmacy Association, the Oregon Society of Health System Pharmacists. The bill creates a 7-member Public Health and Pharmacy Formulary Advisory Committee, specifies membership duties and responsibilities of the committee, also directs the State Board of Pharmacy to establish five-rule drugs and devices that pharmacists may prescribe and dispense to patients under certain conditions here in Oregon, and directs the committee to recommend such drugs and devices, declares emergency. There's a minimal fiscal, no revenue impact. There are no amendments as of yet, and testimonies on OLIS, and it passed out of the House unanimously.
Great. Is it Kara? Is it Weidelkamp? Weidelkamp. Wait. We're on which one? 2301?
2397.
You got two people standing.
Okay, I thought I opened on 2301.
No, you said 2397.
Did I say 2397? Just a minute until we figure out which one I open. Okay, I will.
I thought you said 2301.
Yeah, I thought I said 2301.
Hold it, you said so temporarily.
Okay, I'm going to close whatever bill I opened. 2301. And I am going to open House Bill 2397A. Sorry, yeah. Kara.
We were.
Okay. CNN and I were on the same page, but everyone else heard something else, so sorry about that. Okay, so let us start with, Kevin Russell, Janelle Stinson, and Jill McClellan. Let's start with you people first.
Senator Monica Anderson, members of the committee, thank you for having us here today. My name is Kevin Russell. I am the president of the Oregon State Pharmacy Association. Of course, we represented them today. And I just wanted to state that House Bill 2397 is a natural evolution of the past successes of the pharmacists provided patient care in Oregon. Many years ago, we had successes through the legislature when we passed a bill allowing pharmacists to immunize. The results have been dramatically positive, increasing patient access to vaccinations in Oregon, increasing vaccination rates. Pharmacists now provide a full third of all flu vaccines in the state of Oregon. In 2011, the legislature acted again.
Two-thirds?
One-third. One-third of all flu vaccinations, yeah, in the state of Oregon.
That's where I get mine.
Yeah. And in 2011, the legislature acted again, decreasing vaccination age to 11. And within 3 years, the adolescent immunization rates went up by 10% in Oregon due to pharmacist immunizing. So some past successes that we're building off of here. And in 2015, the legislature passed a landmark bill, 2028, which recognized pharmacists as providers of health care. This bill allowed pharmacists to provide medication management, post-diagnostic disease state management, and collaborative practices with other healthcare providers in the state. And significantly, this bill also allowed the formation of statewide protocols, and it renamed the Immunization and Vaccination Advisory Committee to the Public Health Advisory Committee to approve and oversee protocols. The committee has a multidisciplinary makeup of doctors, nurses, and pharmacists. In the last 2 years, great advances in collaboration and medication management and improved patient health have occurred. However, the intent to create a statewide protocols, that did not occur. And there were questions raised with the Oregon Health Authority as to whether they were the right agency to legally oversee pharmacy practice. And so the solution is this bill, 2397, and it renames the same multidisciplinary committee as the Public Health and Pharmacy Formulary Advisory Committee and moves the committee under the Oregon Board of Pharmacy. This new structure will allow for the statewide protocols to be adopted and quickly implemented after rule writing by the Oregon Board of Pharmacy. So that's one of the key reasons for this bill. There's also been some other significant developments as well. Pharmacists can now prescribe contraceptives in Oregon and naloxone for narcotic overdose, improving access to for the public and improving public health. And now I'm hearing a lot of requests from doctors and patients of why can't pharmacists prescribe glucose machines or test strips or insulin syringes or oral vaccines when they can already do injectable vaccines, over-the-counter drugs maybe. There's broad support for these items. However, requiring legislation for every good public health policy is kind of laborious, expensive, and delays, good public health. So this bill is really the solution to this problem. It allows the Pharmacy Formulary Advisory Committee to approve a formulary of post-diagnostic medications or devices. And another critical point is that the committee and the Board of Pharmacy can then standardize these their rules surrounding prescribing these items, so there's not a different law and set of rules for every drug or device or whatever that gets passed. So, and then finally, there's a letter from CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, to states that was dated January 17, 2017, which we submitted for your review. This guidance encourages states to expand the scope of pharmacist practice to facilitate timely access to drug therapy. It acknowledges that there is a national public health challenge. There's many challenges, and that pharmacists are ideally positioned to help with these challenges. And many states have successfully improved access and public health through pharmacist collaborative practice agreements, state protocols, and standing orders. And House Bill 2397 is exactly the type of legislation that CMS is calling for. So in summary, House Bill 2397, it keeps our multidisciplinary oversight by doctors, nurses, and pharmacists. It establishes an easy and efficient framework under the Oregon Board of Pharmacy. It allows for statewide protocols as intended by House Bill 2028, and it allows for a post-diagnostic formulary without the need for legislative action with each line item. Oregon has a proud history of delivering innovative and collaborative health care, and I think House Bill 2397 will add to this legacy.
Let's hear from the panel and then open it up for questions.
Hi there, Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee. My name is Janelle Stinson, and I'm a pharmacist, and I work within the Legacy Health System in Portland, Oregon. I'm here as a representative today of the Oregon Society of Health System Pharmacists. As you've just heard, House Bill 2397 will allow the public better access to care and more effective medication management. The formulary opportunities proposed today, which would be reviewed and approved by the Pharmacy Formulary Advisory Committee, are drugs and devices that patients routinely need access to, and some are even life-saving, for example, albuterol and epinephrine. Please see the written testimony for formulary opportunities. It has been proven that patient care services provided by pharmacists can lower healthcare costs and improve overall health. One way to ensure cost-effective care for patients is by allowing pharmacists to prescribe commonly used medications and devices for maintenance of public health. Similar to systems recently developed for managing pharmacist-initiated birth control prescriptions, House Bill 2397 will avoid large out-of-pocket expenses for basic medical needs. Pharmacy-driven protocols and drug formularies are common throughout the healthcare field, but they are mostly applied in the hospital setting. It has been shown that when pharmacists manage medications and dose a variety of formulary-approved drugs, they not only reduce costs for the institution, but they improve patient safety and outcomes. Traditionally, a drug formulary or a preferred drug list is a continually updated list of medications and related products which are supported by current evidence-based medicine. The primary purpose of the formulary is to encourage the use of safe, effective, and affordable medications. Now that pharmacists are recognized as providers of healthcare in Oregon, it makes sense that a formulary framework would be created and for pharmacists to work within associated protocols. A few basic examples of medications or devices to include in this formulary are travel medicines, smoking cessation products, and even diabetic supplies. It is very common for insulin to be prescribed, but the lancets, glucometers, and testing strips, which are required for care, are routinely forgotten. This small oversight can lead to big cost issues for patients and place potential roadblocks in their care. Allowing pharmacists to prescribe the necessary diabetic monitoring tools will give patients a quick and cost-effective option. Travel medicines might be added to the formulary so patients have more convenient access to travel-related vaccinations and anti-malarial drugs. Patients are more likely to seek preventative medications for global health when they can obtain them at their local pharmacy instead of having to book appointments at travel clinics. Smoking cessation is another area where pharmacists can have a major impact. Patients generally will try and quit smoking an average of 6 times before they are actually successful. If pharmacists are able to manage nicotine replacement by protocol, they can help relieve the cost burden of over-the-counter prices. They can also tailor therapy to each individual patient's need by prescribing other therapies in addition to nicotine replacement, such as Zyban or Chantix, offering the patient the best chance of quitting. Overall, pharmacists are highly trained and clinically skilled healthcare providers for whom patients have direct access. They work in the most opportune setting to prescribe these basic medications safely, expediently, and at a reduced cost to the patient. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee. My name is Jill McClellan. I'm here today representing the Oregon State Pharmacy Association. I am a community pharmacist practicing in a retail chain store setting in Clackamas County. And while I'm currently working in Oregon, I also hold a pharmacist license to practice in Washington State. There, I have had the pleasure of treating patients for a wide variety of ailments under Washington's pharmacist prescribing structure. My colleagues have covered the CMS guidance to states to expand pharmacist scope of practice. They've reviewed the success of Oregon pharmacists with immunizations, hormonal contraception, and naloxone prescribing. and they provided examples of medications that are well-suited for pharmacists prescribing from a formulary. I would like to talk to you today and share with you some of my experiences of making a positive impact on the health and well-being of my patients in Southwest Washington through expanded pharmacist prescribing, and opportunities that I've experienced in Oregon where patients would benefit from the access that House Bill 2397 will allow. The first prescription I ever wrote was for a diabetic testing supplies. The patient was a longtime customer of mine who was on medical leave due to an automobile accident. She was in transition between insurance plans due to her leave of absence from work and needed to establish care with a new primary care provider. She was going to run out of diabetic testing supplies before she could establish care, and this is where I was able to help. I was able to prescribe her a new meter, test strips, and lancets, and bill all of these devices to her prescription insurance benefit, taking care of the patient in a single visit to the pharmacy. I've had similar encounters with patients in Oregon. Unfortunately, under the current regulations, the best I could do was offer to sell them a small box of test strips at the full retail price, offer to contact their primary care provider for refills, and then wait several days to receive a refill authorization before I could fill a full month's supply under their pharmacy benefit. Many of the other patients I have seen and have been able to prescribe for are generally considered younger, healthier patients with less frequent utilization of the healthcare system. Examples of some of these patients include the busy mother who needed a last-minute refill of EpiPen for her son to take to summer camp. She was not able to wait for the pharmacy to contact her son's physician for a refill, so she chose the pharmacist prescribing service out of convenience. Another example was a recent college graduate who needed a refill on his albuterol inhaler before leaving for a month-long international trip. He met the treatment criteria that had been defined for the pharmacist to prescribe under, and he chose this service so that he could take a brand new rescue inhaler with him on his international trip. I've not had the exact parallel experience to either of these patients in Oregon yet, but with the summer months ahead, I'm sure that I will. A similar encounter that I have experienced in Oregon, however, was a young, healthy, busy, working mom without a regular primary care provider who wanted to quit smoking. She had heard of our pharmacist prescribing services in Washington and wanted to know how I could help her quit. I was limited to recommending over-the-counter nicotine replacement therapy and selling them to her at retail prices. Or I had the option of referring her to a pharmacist in Washington who could prescribe Zyban or Chantix and bill any of her prescription or over-the-counter treatments to her pharmacy benefit. And in each of these cases, as with all of the other patients that I have seen for pharmacist prescribing services, the patients are offered the service as an alternative to waiting on a prescription from their care provider. And then upon agreeing to the service, patients are do answer a brief screening questionnaire, and in some cases undergo a physical assessment by the trained pharmacist. Occasionally, it is determined that the pharmacist prescribing service is not the best route of treatment for the patient, and the patient is then referred back to the primary care provider. I look forward to the opportunity to one day provide the same level of patient care to my patients in Oregon as I have been able to provide to my patients in Washington through expanded pharmacist prescribing. I encourage your approval of House Bill 2397. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
I just have one question. It's a scope bill, they say, but you have a scope of practice protocols and education, all pharmacists. Can you just explain a little bit about your training so you know about safety and precautions and all that goes into writing a prescription? Is that part of the training to become a pharmacist?
Sure, actually. And actually, I think our next person is going to speak just to that, actually.
Okay.
But I guess I'll say that some good examples of the prescribing bills that already went through, which is we had the hormonal contraceptive bill as well as the naloxone, which all involved education, training modules, procedures, under rules written by the Board of Pharmacy that have all been implemented pretty fairly seamlessly in those cases. So there'll be some cases, I'm sure, they'll require some extra training and some rules, and there are other things that we are trained to do already. So.
Okay. Well, I had a pharmacist when we passed the birth control, reproductive health issues. I'm very concerned. Oh, no, I won't be able to do that. But obviously their training is, and now she's so excited about the opportunity to do that. So,
yep, there is a lot of excitement out there.
All right.
Thank you. I'd be a heck of a lot happier if they had a lot of the opportunities to prescribe that they've mentioned. I mean, the diabetic supplies are a really great example. That is a total no-brainer from my perspective. And it would make a big difference in a lot of people's lives. So I think this is a really good change, because we don't have to go through legislation every time that it becomes obvious that there's something else appropriate. And I do have confidence in the board to develop the appropriate education modules, as they did for prescribing hormonal contraception. So I think this is a really good bill.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. And is it Ian Doyle and Bill Cross?
Are you going to the meeting or are you going home?
I was going to support this bill, but now Bill Cross is up.
You don't know my position yet.
Good afternoon, Chair Monson and members of the committee. My name is Ian Doyle. I'm an associate professor and serve as assistant dean of pharmacy practice at Pacific University. I represent the Oregon Society of Health Systems Pharmacists as past president from 2012, and currently serve as co-chair of the Legal and Regulatory Affairs Committee, and also represent the Oregon Pharmacy Coalition. My colleagues have referenced the process of collaborative drug therapy management, also known as CDTM. This is a formal partnership between a pharmacist and physician to allow the pharmacist to manage a patient's drug therapy. CDTM is currently employed in Oregon within health system organizations. Oregon pharmacists have proven their ability in safely selecting drugs, doses, and managing therapy under these auspices. This application of practice to community pharmacies had been previously approved under House Bill 2028. I'll add that I personally have had these experiences working in CDTM in health systems pharmacy, both in an inpatient arena and ambulatory care services. House Bill 2397 will be similar to CDTM. The same principles of committee developed and approved prescribing will be applied. A protocol will be determined and the pharmacists will follow it. Oregon healthcare has been improved by use of similar protocols, which allow pharmacists to prescribe vaccines, birth control, and naloxone. Approving House Bill 2397 will result in similar efficacious results for committee-approved medications. In part, to answer your previous question that you had posed for my panel mates, from the perspective of pharmacy education, curricular redesign has already been underway to ensure student pharmacists receive patient clinical assessment skills training, which are commensurate with these types of advancing roles. Pacific University and Oregon State University are ensuring student pharmacists have these abilities upon graduation without further need of instruction. I encourage you to approve House Bill 2397.
Great. Bill.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Bill Cross. I am here today on behalf of the Oregon Pharmacy Coalition, which is the Oregon State Pharmacy Association, and the Oregon Society of Health System Pharmacists. And I just wanted to take a moment to put on record that because as the bill was coming out of the House committee, a question arose about this advisory board, which had been around for a long time, formerly working on recommendations for vaccinations. But to clarify that it is a public advisory board that has to comport and conform with all the governing rules, rules of governance, public meetings, quorums, majority votes, that type of thing. And so I asked Legislative Council whether that was the case, and just wanted to put on record on this side that indeed the advisory committee is subject to all laws that govern a public body, including those governing notice and minutes requirements, executive session of public bodies, quorum, and majorities. So I just appreciate the opportunity to get that on the record, and with that, do encourage you to support this bill.
Can you list the number, the people that are on this committee?
Madam Chair?
Not the names of the people, but if they have to be a representative of, do they have to be pharmacists, I guess?
Madam Chair, committee members, the advisory board will be 7 members, 3 of them pharmacists, one of those to be from a community pharmacy, one from a health or from a health system pharmacy, and then 4 prescribers, 2 physicians and 2 nurses with prescribing authority. So there would be a majority on this board of prescribers, but with the growing interaction and as we've as we've moved along, I don't think really there's going to be a lot of contentious discussions about most of what this the opportunities here are.
Wonderful. Other questions? Yes, Senator.
Just a comment to echo Senator Steiner Hayward. And Madam Chair, you know as well as I do, for the last decade, we've been doing a lot of work to increase access to health care. This is just another step in that direction.
Yeah. Other comments?
I think it's just an expansion of our concept of interprofessional teams providing care and everybody working up the level of his or her license. And I'm really supportive of this.
Wonderful. All right. There's no one signed up. No one else signed up. I think that we can schedule this for work session also, and we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2397A, and let's open a public hearing on House Bill 2301A.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you is House Bill 2301A, brought to you by the Oregon Health Authority. It's a housekeeping bill for OHA. There's staff here in the room to testify. There are no amendments. There's a no revenue impact, and there's a minimal fiscal impact. Both statements are on OLIS. And this passed out of the House unanimously, 58.
Now Kara can come talk to us.
Okay, thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Mona Sanderson, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kara Biddlecombe. I'm the Director of Policy and Partnerships for the Public Health Division in the Oregon Health Authority. I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 2301A. This is the housekeeping bill for the Oregon Health Authority, for which I'll speak to the components that impact the Public Health Division. The majority of this bill makes simple procedural changes that will align reporting and investigations for boards that are maintained by the Public Health Division's Health Licensing Office. Several of the boards under the office jurisdiction have mixed statutory authority regarding investigations and disclosure and confidentiality. This measure streamlines those authorities and allows conformity with administration where necessary. The measure also takes into consideration keeping certain information confidential, which is consistent with other confidentiality laws, specifically ORS 676-175, and allows discretion if disclosure of information could be used to identify the complainant to the person who is subject to the investigation. I'll briefly list the remaining areas of the bill. It changes qualifications to register as an environmental health specialist and an environmental health specialist trainee. Modifies membership composition on the State Trauma Advisory Board, Area Trauma Advisory Boards, and the State Emergency Medical Service Committee. It also repeals the Oregon Pulse Registry Advisory Committee. The bill makes a series of changes that would bring Oregon's State Cancer Registry OSCR into alignment with national standards while also increasing OHA's ability to effectively provide high-quality cancer data. This is Oregon's leading cause of death. The bill provides clarification for the oversight of required provision of educational trainings on the treatments for life-threatening allergies, adrenal insufficiency, or hypoglycemia. Aligns state youth marijuana curriculum requirements with local control of curriculum adoption. Repeals some outdated procedural language related to community-based healthcare initiatives and managed healthcare consortium. And it repeals the requirement for an annual healthcare acquired infections report that's now duplicative with federal efforts, repeals the sunset on mandatory reporting of healthcare acquired infections to the National Health Safety Network, and it makes a minor change to the composition of the Healthcare Acquired Infection Advisory Committee. So with that, I appreciate your time this afternoon and would be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Yes, Senator Cruz.
Just a comment, the repeal of the Post Registry Advisory Committee, is that because that work's done?
It's done.
And so if we needed changes, we'd have to reinstitute.
Kara, you could probably answer that better than I, but I don't think...
I don't anticipate, but, okay.
Yeah.
Sure. Vice Chair Cruz, Senator Steiner Hayward, the Pulse Registry Advisory Committee has completed all of its statutory requirements. So the repeal just takes this group out of statute because they've completed all of their duties. I believe the registry is all set up. And
I understand that. You know, 20 years from now, we may want to do...
It's an interesting point, Madam Chair, if I may. It's an interesting point, which is... Does this give us a mechanism? Is there sort of a miscellaneous advisory committee, as it were, that can be used, or can it go through the regular rulemaking process at that point? I see Ms. Heiberg nodding her head back there, that it can go through the regular rulemaking process. You don't need a separate advisory committee. That makes sense. I mean, because that's a public process, and there's a RAC and whatever that would include all the stakeholders. So I think that would work.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, maybe. the Pulse was very controversial for a while. Very controversial. I think it probably depends on what.
No, I don't think the Pulse is a controversial one.
It's the directives is
yeah,
more direct.
The advanced directives.
The Pulse is different. Widely accepted now and, in fact, used in many states in the union.
Yeah.
So.
But if there was something controversial, I'm sure we'd hear about it. So. One way or the other.
It does bring up the interesting point, which is not really relevant to this bill, but whether we should still call it the Pulse, given that we just changed it for net to include naturopathic physicians and PAs and things like that. And so it's still the physician. In some states, it's the MOLS, the medical orders for life-sustaining treatment, but I think that's parsing too fine a splitting hairs.
Yeah,
but
maybe.
Anyway,
it's known, what it is. Let's not mess with it.
I know. I'm just saying.
No, we did pass legislation that will allow.
No, we did. We did. But it's still a Pulse, and let's just leave it at that.
Okay.
So.
All right. I'm just saying that we'll see what happens. All right. There's no opposition. There's nothing at this point in time. Are you comfortable with moving the bill? Okay, so we'll schedule this one, too. All right, thank you
very much.
I will close the public hearing on 2301. And we're now ready for 2432, and Senator Dembro wanted to testify. I think Logan, his staff, needs to pull him down here right away, and let's be at recess. We'll give him,
So Logan texted me, Senator Dembro, he's not going to be here until 2.
Okay, so Senator Dembro can't be here till 3. So let's go ahead and open a public hearing on House Bill 2432A and go ahead and describe.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you is House Bill 2432A, brought to you by Senator Dembro and Representative Parrish. The bill directs the Oregon Health Authority's Health Licensing Office to issue licenses to practice art therapy to qualified art therapists, specifies license qualifications, and requires licensed art therapists to comply with rules adopted by the Health Licensing Office. There is a fiscal impact statement on OLIS. There's no revenue impact. There's a -5 and a -6 amendment. The -5 expands the type of professionals able to engage in the practice of art therapy without a license, and the -6 removes reference to professions that may use art therapy in a manner that's incidental to the person's practice.
Great. Let's call, is it Sally Kyle? Yes. Madam Mary Andrus and Laura Beer. Who wants to start?
Mary.
Okay.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, Vice Chair, and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to talk with you about our bill. My name is Mary Andrus. I am the Program Director of the Art Therapy Counseling Program at Merrillhurst University, and I've been spearheading this effort for licensure of art therapists in the state of Oregon. I am going to talk briefly about the bill in the sense of what it is and what it is not. So art therapy is a profession, a distinct mental health profession, in which entering the practice as an art therapist, you have to have at least a master's degree in art therapy. And at minimum, there is postgraduate clinical experience where you work for at least 4 years getting your clinical hours, working towards your ATR. And in doing so, graduates must complete at least 1,000 hours of supervised direct client contact in order to qualify for the ATR. And that is the lower level of the license that we're trying to put in place. So that would be the licensed art therapist designation. Beyond that, art therapists have to take a credential board certified examination, and that allows them to get the ATRBC, or art therapist registered board certified. And all credentialed art therapists must commit to ethical practice, the standards of the ATCB's code of professional practice, and maintain continuing education. So they have 100 hours of continuing education every 5 years in order to keep their credentials active. And that would be, the ATRBC would be the next level of professional practice in this particular bill. There is confusion in the world around what art therapy is. And you might walk into your grocery store and see an art therapy coloring book. We are trying to establish ourselves as professional people who are just creating a level of communication with the public about what art therapy is and what it's not. So qualified art therapists understand the power of art and art making to unlock memories and reveal emotions. The use of art therapy methods or art materials thus carries significant risk for the emotional stability of clients if applied by individuals lacking appropriate training. Potential risks from unqualified practice of art therapy include misinterpreting or ignoring assessments the practitioner has not been clinically trained to diagnose or treat, eliciting adverse responses from clients that they're not properly trained to manage or treat, and delaying appropriate therapeutic treatment that adds unnecessary anguish and cost for clients and their families. This potential for harm is magnified where a client has a vulnerable psychological predisposition. So this public confusion around art therapy and potential for harm from unqualified practitioners have increased with growing numbers of online and university-based programs that claim to provide degrees and certificate trainings in areas that sound like art therapy, but they're not art therapy. These programs don't require this minimal on-site coursework, self-instruction in regards to the rigorous coursework, supervised clinical training, and national credentialing of professional art therapists. We are one of several states in the United States that are working towards trying to pass a bill for art therapists, and I'm finishing up my doctorate in art therapy currently, and I think passing this bill will help the profession move forward in a level of competence and making sure that we're ensuring the public are being treated ethically and responsibly. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for your consideration of this bill. My name's Laura Beer, and I am the Chair of Counseling and Creative Therapies at Merrillhurst University. I oversee the art therapy program, and I'm also a board-certified and Oregon State-licensed music therapist. So, as you know, music therapy went through this process recently, and in the year since we achieved licensure, we have been able to successfully defend our profession from people and companies that purport to have music therapy as part of their services when, in fact, they're not services provided by a licensed professional. And that has been a really invigorating and strengthening move for us to be able to take with our profession. And I also want to speak to the education that art therapists undergo. It's a very intensive, rigorous education with a dual emphasis on mental health counseling. And the work being done by art therapists cannot be underestimated. I've seen the power of art therapy with children who are in inpatient psychiatric units who have medication and structure helping them figure out their world, but it's been art therapy that has helped them find their voice and to move forward with their lives. So I highly recommend this bill. I strongly support it with the Dash 5 amendment. And I, again, appreciate your time and your service to our community. Thank you.
I did get an email from art therapists that were very concerned about the wording in the bill, which it says they wish that the wording could be that other professionals may utilize art, but not art therapy. And that is evidently how musical therapists in have it, which states that other professionals may utilize music, but not music therapy. And I know, Mary, can you, because they mentioned you in the email, can you address that issue? Are you aware of
yes,
it?
I'm. Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. The A5 amendment does speak to that. The first of that line, it clarifies that line in the bill stating that people can use art incidentally in their practice, right, which aligns with what's written in the music therapy bill. I think it was an error in the previous amendment to make it say art therapy.
Madam Chair, technical question. We have the fives and sixes, and looks like the sixes make just a grammatical thing that the fives missed. Is that correct, or have you looked at both?
Yes. Six actually obliterates that sentence in altogether, and five actually keeps the sentence but clarifies that change of removing the word therapy.
In working with the
occupational therapists, we want to make sure that we're supporting their work, and that's something that they asked we do. So, yeah.
So the five.
Five is the correct one.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Sally Giles, and I'm an art therapist. I've been in practice for 15 years, and I think a lot has already been said in support of this bill that I recommend, or that I agree with as well. But maybe I can share a couple of examples that illustrate why this is important. A great deal of my work is with older adults in long-term care communities. And art therapy is very powerful with that population, as it is with all populations. And the arts are increasingly being offered in those settings, which is a wonderful development in our culture. And there's a lot of research about how art and fine art and art classes and art therapy are really beneficial for this group of people. But it is leading to some confusion. So, for example, the retirement community where I work now, when I was first hired there, I noticed that they offered art therapy weekly on their calendar of events. And I was thrilled by this as an art therapist until I learned that it really was a craft group. So a person who didn't have any art therapy training was coming and offering a craft to a group of interested people who enjoyed all making a version of the same thing. Which is a beautiful thing, and people enjoyed that, and I'm in favor of it. I'm just not in favor of calling it art therapy, because that person didn't have the training and didn't provide the structure and individualized attention, the evaluation that an art therapist would do. So it's creating confusion for people who think that art therapy is a craft group, and if they say, oh, well, I'm not really interested in crafts, they would miss the opportunity to do some deep and powerful work with an art therapist. Another example I want to share, I was looking for a therapist for my daughter, and I was looking online at the offerings of different therapists, and I found a therapist who offered counseling, EMDR, which is a trauma therapy, and animal-assisted therapy, as well as art therapy. And this practitioner listed their education and their certifications and the professional organizations they belong to for all of the work that she did, except for art therapy. She didn't really have any training in that area. So among professionals, there is even confusion about what constitutes art therapy. So again, I think it's important that professionals and non-professionals understand the distinction between creative arts, which is beneficial for everyone, and art therapy, which is something distinct and different and provides deeper and richer opportunities. And not only that, handles sensitive ethical decisions and knows about the evocative qualities of certain art materials and how to apply those sensitively and ethically with individuals. Finally, I just want to say that my work with older adults in long-term care has been so rewarding, and it's, you know, a growing need in our society to provide care for older adults, and art therapy is one of the most profound interventions I've ever seen, particularly for people who are experiencing memory loss from neurocognitive impairments. Using nonverbal means of self-expression can be such a relief and such a powerful intervention for someone who's no longer able to understand or use language the way they used to. So in conclusion, I just want to reiterate, art therapy is a distinct profession. It's not a supplemental technique, and it offers unique mental health and wellness benefits for a wide range of people. An art therapy license will help us protect the public by clarifying the difference between art therapy and other arts programming. And recognition with a state license will help increase the awareness and availability of this valuable profession to those who can benefit the most.
So tell me, what is included in art therapy? I would think painting, pottery. Mm-hmm. I mean, tell me, what are you trained in?
Go ahead.
Chair Manas Anderson, thanks for the question. So art therapy encompasses a wide range of art materials. That's one of the main things we learn, is how to use three-dimensional and two-dimensional art materials with a degree of skill that we can safely help others learn about them, and also so that we can individualize which materials we offer to which person at which time. So some materials might be appropriate to help a person rein in big feelings or help them calm down, and other materials might help a person draw themselves out and express themselves more fully. And depending on the person and the situation and what that person's abilities are, different materials would be called for.
But I need to know what the materials are.
Sure. So painting, drawing, sculpture, fiber arts, mixed media, chime in, please.
Yes, thank you, Representative or Senator Monty Anderson. I would. It's a complete range from, okay, like using video to sewing to drawing to sculpting to carving to building. It's not limited by any one particular material or media. But what the art therapist is trained to do is to know the sensitivity of this material would work best for this particular person with this developmental need, this cognitive need, this cultural background and identity, and know not to put something that's going to be very messy and make the person kind of fall apart. Like someone who's psychotic may really struggle with paint, but feel like much more controlled with a circle that's already pre-drawn and they have to color inside of it. Like that helps them to feel more in control. So the art therapist is trained to know which materials and media to integrate at different times with different people. And like a teenager may be more interested in creating art on an iPad than rendering self-portrait with pencils. Sure. So the art therapist is trained to be able to work with different people with different needs.
That's great. I know this was many, many years ago at a psychiatric hospital. They used art therapy. I assume it was art therapy, but it was actually building things with wood. Mm-hmm. And some of the male patients that they had, the male patients were more prone to find satisfaction and from that media. Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much. No further discussion? All right. I think we can schedule this for a work session, too, if you want to put that on the agenda. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2432, and we have finished for the day. We're adjourned. Finished for the day. We're adjourned.